My name is Maggie Mastin, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I am joined by David McMahon, the Charles A. Dana Professor of Religious Studies at Franklin and Marshall College. He is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a Clark Forum program tonight titled The World as We Would Have It Be, Collective Thriving in the Time Place of Collapse. This will be a conversation between Professor McMahon and Norma Wong, a Zen master, political strategist, and author from Hawaii. Today, he is joining me for an interview. Welcome, David McMahon.
Thank you.
So to begin, I was hoping you could share how you were first introduced to the subject of Buddhism. Was it more like a personal engagement through practice or a relationship of sorts or life experience? Or was it through an academic setting?
It started out more personal. I grew up in a very conservative Christian household, and when I started to question that, I found myself looking through various books at bookstores and, you know, happened upon some books on Zen and Buddhism and other things. And so I pretty early in my life, in my teens, I guess, mid-teens, started exploring worldviews and different ways of seeing things, and eventually kind of made a job out of it.
Yeah. When did that interest turn more academic for you? Was it in a college setting?
It was. I started to experiment on my own a little bit with meditation and things like that, just from books. And then when I got to college, there was actually a Zen teacher who taught some classes there, but was also a teacher of meditation. So I studied with him the whole time I was in college. So it was both kind of an academic and a personal study. And I was planning on going into philosophy in graduate school, but I was interested in Asian philosophy. And I realized after a while that Asian philosophy was mostly studied in religious studies departments. And I had no experience of a religious studies department at that point. But I started to look around and eventually settled on that path. And so I got my master's at Florida State and my PhD at the University of California at Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm. So that first teacher really served as kind of a mentor
for you
as you're moving through that process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel as though your personal practice has an influence on some of your scholarly work then?
You know, probably technically it's not supposed to, but people say that, but of course, you know, your personal life always influences your professional life,
sure,
no matter what. And so, yeah, I would say so. You know, some of the, and I'm sort of a, you know, I'm not a really diligent practitioner, I should say. I'm probably a you know, kind of more Buddhist than Buddhist, but I have had, you know, a kind of steady meditative practice throughout my life. And I think some of the questions that came up in trying various meditative techniques did inform some of my questions that I then thought about academically. And, you know, at first I was sort of trained to look at ancient Buddhist material, texts and literature in India. And so I learned Sanskrit and various languages to try and navigate that. And then when I started to study ancient texts and I started also to travel in Asia, I just noticed there was a big gap between what I thought of as Buddhism and Hinduism as well in the West, the stuff that I'd been exposed to in America, versus what I saw in Asia and what I saw in texts. And so I started thinking, how do I make sense of that? You know, is it just wrong the way we've gotten it, or is it just another development? And so I started to think beyond just my training in more ancient literature to how Buddhism sort of takes shape in various modern cultures. And that set me off on a whole other career trajectory.
Yeah.
And so I've been writing on that quite a bit since then.
So in your work, analyzing Buddhism as it has evolved from ancient times to more modern times,
mm-hmm,
I'm curious, and with your own experience on meditation, I'm curious how you interpret the use of meditation and mindfulness in the more kind of Western therapeutic or wellness setting that it's often encountered in.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, for over 2,000 years, these practices have sort of had one institutional home, and that's the Buddhist Sangha, the Buddhist monastic community. And now it has institutional homes in Google, Goldman Sachs, the US military, maybe not anymore. But yeah, it's just exploded. And it's a really striking phenomenon, given the fact that these practices were developed in ancient India over 2,500 years ago by ascetics who left their families, left their communities, left their duties to do something really radical and strange and countercultural, and they sort of developed these internal practices out in the forest. And so it was originally not something to sort of help you do your job better or you know, cope with your relationships better or anything, but they've been essentially in the last century sort of given by the Buddhist tradition to the broader world. And the broader world has taken these traditions and done a lot of other things with them. And sort of it's these meditation practices have developed a life of their own, sometimes in therapeutic settings. You know, some of my students will hear about meditation from their football coach or their music teachers. Mm-hmm. So it's seen as something that's more generally applicable to a lot of different aspects of life. And that's I think a fairly new development, not completely new, but a fairly new development in the history, that long history of meditation.
And now they're also starting to connect a lot of the mindfulness or manifestation in terms of like sports practices and things like you were talking about and how that's kind of, it's something that's been around for a long time, but now it just looks very different.
Yeah.
Would you say it's more than like a continuation of Buddhist traditions or something fundamentally different than what it used to be?
Well, that lineage is there. And I think, you know, probably more people should acknowledge that this came from those traditions. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, it's a real debate involving how, you know, how do we see these practices once they're sort of taken out of their Buddhist context? Can we just do with it what we want, or do we still owe some allegiance to some of the ethical concerns that they were nestled in the Buddhist tradition? And, you know, it's a very fraught issue. I mean, there are debates about whether, you know, you should be using these kinds of practices for making loads of money and on Wall Street and, you know, operating a hedge fund or becoming a better sniper. But again, these things have had multiple uses in the past. Usually they were designed to alter states of consciousness and ultimately achieve enlightenment. But for instance, in Japanese culture, samurais took up Zen meditation and used the kind of states of mind that it would generate to help them in sword fighting. And so, you know, the applicability to other things is not completely unprecedented. It's just that in the modern world, it's really just hit the fan and gone everywhere. So that, you know, I mean, all my students have heard of it now, whereas when I first started teaching, not nearly as many had. And most of my students, if I ask, well, you know, raise your hand if you've done some meditation or mindfulness practice, at least half have already done it.
I remember in middle school it was like an option of something that they would have us do alongside our like health courses and such. Taking Buddhism as more of like the religion itself, could you talk about when some of the main differences in how they used to practice it in ancient times versus how people practice it in modern times?
Yeah, well, we don't really know how widespread it was in the very, very early parts of Buddhism. It seems that it was not directed exclusively to the monastic community then, but gradually it sort of became mainly a monastic practice. So if you just kind of run into an average Buddhist in Thailand or Japan or something and ask them if they meditate, they'll probably say no, or very, very infrequently. And they may well say, well, that's something the monks do. You know, and they might even have a little hesitation to do it themselves because they feel like they don't know what they're doing. That's something for more advanced people. That's kind of like me as an undergraduate trying to do PhD work, you know. And so that's been the sense for a lot of the history of Buddhism in a lot of times and places. And that changed starting actually about 100, 150 years ago when, and interestingly, it's through colonialism that it started to change. Places like, and we were just talking about this in the class that I sat in on yesterday, the British, for example, colonized Burma, and this weakened Buddhism quite a bit from an institutional standpoint. There was a lot of missionizing Christians there, and there were monks, especially one in particular, who decided, you know, in order for Buddhism to survive and thrive, we've got to do something different. We can't just keep meditation and philosophy for the monks as this kind of exclusive practice. So he started to set up centers to teach the general population because he wanted the Buddhist religion to continue thriving. And part of what he did was teach ordinary people meditation, basic meditation techniques. So this started kind of a mass meditation movement in Southeast Asia that spread. And by about mid-20th century, there were a lot of meditation centers around Asia, and other countries were doing this too. And then Americans started to go over and take classes and study with some of these teachers and then bring it back to America. And they had to think about, well, how do we present it to Americans? We're not going to have all the Buddhist stuff, and we're not going to do some rituals so much. And so already there was a kind of reshaping of Buddhism to fit into American culture a little bit better. Mm-hmm. So that's been some of the changes within Buddhism.
Yeah, and then through some of those Western movements too, I know that you've worked on like how it's evolved through Transcendentalism and the Romantic period. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about what those periods, how they impacted Buddhism in the West?
Sure. So Buddhism sort of entered the global stage around this same time in the late 19th century. And because of colonization, a lot of the general Western perception of places that were colonized, like in Asia and Africa, were that these were sort of benighted heathens and you know, they were ignorant and superstitious. And Buddhists' response to that was pretty strategic. They said, look, we've got a lot of really complex philosophy, every bit as complex as you see in the West. We've got practices that sort of resemble some things that are emerging in psychology in the West. And we've got a really strong rational tradition that in some ways they said resonates with science. We emphasize cause and effect. And they knew that Christianity at the time was also experiencing some pressure from emerging scientific traditions. And so there were a lot of people in the West who were educated people who were finding it difficult to believe in the miracles involved in Christianity. Maybe they were having a hard time believing in a God, a soul, an immaterial soul. And Buddhists came along and said, that's fine. We don't need any of that. You can be a Buddhist and not, you know, we can accept evolution. We accept laws of nature and things like that. And so they sort of positioned themselves as a religion that is more in harmony with modern science than Christianity. And again, this comes out of that colonial context. And Transcendentalism, Romanticism also come in because while a lot of people in the West, and I think around the world at this time, were starting to have their traditional faiths destabilized and they were questioning their more traditional worldviews, they didn't want to just live in a completely desacralized world. You know, they wanted some kind of spiritual sense about life. And so Transcendentalism, Romanticism was a kind of counterbalance to the more mechanistic scientific worldview. They emphasized deep feeling, they emphasized inner interiority, inner life, deep emotion. They saw the world more as a kind of organism rather than a mechanism. And so Buddhism also drew on some of that language and sort of mediated that tension between Romanticism and scientific rationalism. And so that's sort of the space, I think, that Buddhism staked out kind of on the global stage starting in late 19th century.
So its connection to science and psychology in a way helped legitimize it in the West a bit, but it was also a very conscious approach by Buddhists.
Yeah, very much.
On how to keep their practice alive.
Exactly. And that's how, you know, you asked how I got to thinking about it in modern context. It's not a kind of neat cultural appropriation story. It's not really just that Westerners sort of took this stuff and did with, I mean, to some extent later on they did, but this Buddhist modernism really was shaped first by Asians themselves. And they at first were sort of representing certain maybe fragmentary aspects of Buddhism to the general public, but that sort of took on a life of its own too and became a whole new form of Buddhism and a way of practicing Buddhism and a way of seeing Buddhism. Definitely the immigrant experience has been huge in the development of Buddhism in the West. The first wave of immigrants came during that same time, late 19th, early 20th century. A lot of them were on the West Coast, and they were mostly from East Asia, China, Japan, and they were brought in to work the railroads and mines and things like that. And they're the ones who really brought the practice of Buddhism to the West, and they set up, you know, temples in Chinatown and things like that. There was a big gap in immigration. They had moratoriums basically on Asian immigration for a good part of the early part of the 20th century, and then during the 60s they started opening it up again, and so we had a whole new wave of often refugees from Buddhist countries like Myanmar, Tibet, refugees from the Vietnam War. So all of them also brought their Buddhism to the United States. So here you have a mixture. On the one hand, you have communities of Buddhists who are coming here, you know, trying to make a life in the United States, but also trying to maintain some continuity with their Buddhism of their homeland. And so Buddhist temples sort of became community centers. They became sort of ethnically based. But then also alongside of that, you have Westerners with no particular Asian background, with no particular heritage connection with Buddhism, who are just discovering it through books and through college classes, and they're interested. And so there's some crossover there, but there's also some real separation, you know, and there's a muddy middle where you have, you might have third generation, say Japanese folks who, you know, grandma practiced Buddhism in one way, but I'm more of a modern, you know, mindfulness meditator. So so there's a lot of interesting sort of variations on those both, but those are two sort of separate but maybe parallel communities of Buddhism.
Yeah. Is that really how we see, like, Buddhist literature and studies entering, like, the college atmosphere, too, is, like, through those exchanges and such?
Yeah, because, you know, there have been some of the immigrants who have tried to you know, spread Buddhism. It hasn't always been a kind of proselytizing religion and everything, but there's definitely you know, some blurry line, as I said, between the immigrants who just came here and wanted to practice their own tradition and didn't really care about how it interacted with mainstream American culture, and those who, you know, in addition, like, to their community temple, maybe they open up some meditation classes every Saturday and have all kinds of people from various communities coming to that.
The transcendentalism movement, wasn't that really associated with, like, nature and reconnecting with nature?
Yeah.
How has Buddhism historically intersected with, like, ideas of nature, and how was that impacted by the transcendentalism movement?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say, so the earliest Buddhism comes out of India, and the orientation there is not so much towards nature. In fact, the earliest Buddhists really were trying to get out of nature. They were trying to transcend the world to a kind of a transcendent, blissful existence that wasn't encumbered by material reality. But pretty quickly, there started to become ideas of, well, you know, maybe if we really see the world as it is, maybe it's this wondrous, maybe it itself is nirvana. And so then when Buddhism starts to travel, especially to East Asia, so to China and Japan, they already have a tradition of reverence for nature. And so you start getting ideas like, well, the Buddha is not just this person who existed several hundred years ago. The Buddha, everything has Buddha nature in it. You know, the rocks, the trees, the grass, the human beings, the animals. So it's a way of sort of sacralizing the world. So then when those traditions end up sort of mingling with transcendentalism, Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, they're some of the first ones in the West really who start looking at these traditions and saying, hey, there's something cool there. These are not just sort of superstitious others, you know. And so they start appreciating some of the texts that revere nature and mingling it with their own philosophy a little bit. And then if you move forward a little bit from that, you have movements like environmental movements, deep ecology, for instance, which, you know, sees all of life as deeply intertwined. And so now I think there's a particular Buddhist understanding of interdependence. And that's an idea that goes way back in Buddhism. And I think it's attained a new significance now that we are literally very interdependent. Everything is connected with everything else. We have these global communication networks. Our economies are intertwined with economies around the world. We know that the climate is very intertwined. That, you know, things that happen in one part of the world are going to have adverse effects on things in the other side of the world. So all of a sudden, this Buddhist interdependence has become sort of a central image, a central idea in how Buddhists sort of think of their own philosophy. One image that really has become very popular in recent times it's called the Net of Indra. And it's from a number of ancient texts, but it's sort of been repurposed today. It imagines a big net that goes out infinitely into space, and at each juncture is a little jewel that is reflective. And so if you look at each jewel, you see the reflection of every other jewel, and that jewel is also reflected in each other jewel. So it's this sort of like one thing is connected with everything in the world. Everything in the world is sort of manifest in this one thing. And so it becomes a kind of metaphor of ecology, of, you know, ethical interdependence and so on.
Yeah. I'm curious to hear, because Buddhism has also really been connected with psychology and like studying the state of the mind. Has there been connections between that and maybe people trying to achieve enlightenment or nirvana?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, achieving nirvana, I think, has become a little bit more, it's always held as like the far ideal, mm-hmm. but on the ground, I think there haven't been all that many Buddhists who are sort of saying, okay, my whole thing is to achieve nirvana,
yeah.
right? It's seen often among more traditional Buddhist communities as something very far off, as something maybe that's just very difficult, maybe even impossible to attain in the world today.
And do you think that's consistent with more ancient practices? Maybe that's also how they might have viewed that?
Well, you know, if you believe the early Buddhist literature, you have people getting enlightened quite a bit. People
yeah.
hear the Buddha give a talk and, you know, practice for a couple of years and boom, they're enlightened. But that's the literature, you know, and whether people, again, I think it didn't necessarily translate on the ground to, I'm going to really try this. Now, I'm not mm-hmm. saying there aren't people whose goal isn't that, and mm-hmm. there haven't been throughout history, but the majority of Buddhists have lived their Buddhism more through kind of ethical practices, through rituals, through, you know, donation to the Sangha and community life.
It's become more of a way of life
instead
of just an end goal.
Right. Yeah. And then, so you asked about the psychology part. I think that's a little bit separate from the idea of enlightenment. That's mm-hmm. more a matter of, well, can we use some of these practices to improve our life now? Can we use it to sort of work with the mind in a more productive, fruitful way? Can we make the mind a little bit more flexible and less neurotic? And definitely there has been, you know, a many decades long history of trying to integrate psychology and Buddhist meditation. So, for instance, famous psychologist Eric Fromm, mid-20th century, he saw Zen Buddhism as a matter of sort of excavating the entire unconscious, so you could see the whole thing. You know, typical psychoanalysis would say, okay, you're getting some kind of weird symptom, and that's because you've repressed something, it's down in your unconscious, and we're going to try to get it out of you. And then, you know, maybe you have a little revelation, oh, that's where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. But that's it. You know, you get that symptom taken care of, and then you go on your way, and you, according to Freud, live your relatively unhappy life still, but not plagued by that particular kind of neurosis. But Fromm is saying, well, you know, certain kinds of meditative techniques allow you to just like uproot the whole thing and make your whole unconscious visible. So that's one lens through which people have seen. But more recently, it's really worked itself into a lot of other psychological theories. You know, cognitive behavioral therapy has integrated a lot of mindfulness techniques, humanistic psychology in the 60s and 70s. And more recently, there's a big wave of studying meditators neuropsychologically, sticking them into MRI machines and trying to see what their brains are doing. A lot of tests on meditative effects of meditation on, say, various health issues, whether it's high blood pressure or anxiety or depression and things like that. So there's a huge amount of scientific research that's being done on meditation recently.
Is that the background that you find a lot of students come into your classes having?
I think so, yeah. And that's increased quite a bit over the last, I would say, 2 decades. If they've read about meditation, they've, you know, maybe seen it in Scientific American, you know, where they're talking about all these neuroscientists who are studying meditators.
As a professor teaching about East Asian religions and all these practices at FNM in like a modern Western context, what are some of the biggest challenges that you've encountered trying to translate these ideas?
First of all, it's just the breadth of the tradition is kind of overwhelming to people. On the first day of my Buddhism class, I say there's no such thing as Buddhism. There are Buddhisms, and there are a lot of different Buddhisms. So when you're talking about 15th century Japanese Buddhism in this particular context, it's very different from 7th century Indian Buddhism. So there's a challenge of, okay, do we try to cover everything? Do we try to hit every little form it's taken? And I think that's futile in one semester. So, I try to zero in on a particular number of examples. And of course, you know, we're all attention challenged now. We all have been for forever, according to Buddhism. You know, they have this image of the monkey mind as our natural state. Our minds are just like a monkey zipping around from tree to tree, and it's just hard to focus on anything, but now even more, right? So I think students are interested in developing some kind of self-regulation, self-cultivation, being able to regulate their attention, because there's so many people, institutions, apps, you know, giant tech companies that are really trying to harvest their attention. And so I think some students come in thinking, well, this might help me with that a little bit. I can't focus on anything. I can't concentrate on anything. I can't get my work done. How do I sort of calm my mind down? Sort of balancing that with just a history of Buddhism and recognizing that there are forms of Buddhism that may not resonate with everybody, may not sort of conform to the stereotype that people have of Buddhism in the West as being, you know, a particular thing. So it's just a matter of getting a balance between those elements.
Yeah. Have you found it difficult in any way for students to leave behind some of their own religious practices in the classroom and approach it from more of like a scholarly perspective?
I don't think that's been a big problem. I've had, you know, people from all different religions, and if they show up in a class on Buddhism, I assume they're curious about it. Mm-hmm. And the academic study of religion, of course, doesn't presume or require that you are religious, not religious, Buddhist, Hindu, you know, it just doesn't address that. You can be whatever you are personally and still study the material academically. I do sometimes have some little, I just call them meditative experiments in my classes, where we'll just try some very basic meditative techniques just to give them an experiential flavor. And I say, you know, if this is, you know, going to clash with your religious convictions or anything, you know, no obligation to do it.
Mm-hmm. You've gotten a lot of interest from students in trying to access some of those experiences, or maybe looking for someone to help lead them through it.
Yeah. I often get students asking me, you know, what if I want to sort of pursue this a little bit, what mm-hmm. are some good books or maybe places to go for a retreat or something like that.
Yeah. I also wanted to ask about your interest in the arts mm. and some of your own art and music that you create, because mm. you do mixed media, collage, and assemblage pieces, and they're really beautiful. Where do you draw some of your inspiration for those pieces from?
Thank you, yeah. So, a lot of these pieces are sort of playing with patterns that recur at really big levels and really small levels, so I'll collage together like some satellite imagery of rivers going through a desert, and then it'll sort of merge with neurons, you know, on x-rays and electron microscope imagery, and then just photos that I've taken. So I've always sort of dabbled in art, and this is a new sort of medium that I've started to play with. I think I started it during COVID. You know, needed something different to do with all the time I was spending at home. And I don't know. I've always just been really, I think the first time I remember being in a plane and I was flying over a desert, and I looked down and I just, it was just astonishing to me to have that huge view and to see these ancient rivers sort of winding their way through the desert. I just really started to think about how, you know, the kind of basic forces of nature that create different patterns at huge levels and small levels. So mm-hmm. I wanted to explore that a little bit in the art.
I find it really interesting that you add the woven pieces on the side of mm-hmm. them, because they kind of add another dimension that's outside of just what's kind of flat on the front.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Old clothes.
Is that where you get the material?
A lot of, yeah. If my wife is throwing away a dress or something, I go, let's see what we have there.
Where else do you said you take your own pictures?
Yeah.
And that's what you use in a lot of them. Where else do you find materials for the actual images that you're using?
Yes, well, whenever I'm traveling, I like to sort of see if I'm seeing new surfaces, and you know, some of it will be rocks and bark on trees and patterns in sand, and so yeah, I just always sort of have my eye out for just interesting images.
Mm-hmm. Do each of the pieces have like their own individual theme or memory that you connect to them?
It's
two ideas that you're connecting together or something.
Yeah,
like that.
A little bit of both. I mean, sometimes I'll be putting things together and I'll realize, oh, there is a theme here, and I'll pursue that a little bit. Sometimes mm-hmm. I might focus on pictures from a particular place, because there'll be a certain coherence and maybe color coherence with the images. There sometimes are sort of very somewhat ambiguously defined themes to each piece, but sometimes I don't know what they are until I'm already making the piece.
All right. Well, I think this will conclude our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you for having this conversation with
me. Thanks
so
much. It was a pleasure.